ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, we've got for you the first half of a panel discussion reviewing the recent debate between Rice University chemistry professor, Dr. James Tuer, and the University of Glasgow professor of chemistry, Dr. Lee Cronin. In November 2023, Drs. Tuer and Cronin participated in a roundtable at Harvard University on the origin of life, with a live audience of Harvard faculty and guests. If you missed it, the debate is available on YouTube. But even if you haven't seen the debate, you're still likely to find this review helpful, because it teases out a number of points from the debate with useful insight and a variety of perspectives. The panel features three of our own: scientist and attorney Casey Luskin, physicist Brian Miller, and Center for Science and Culture Senior Fellow Dr. Stephen Dilley. It also features Arizona State University Professor of Philosophy Owen Anderson. The discussion was recorded by the Kirkwood Center and hosted by Kirkwood President Anthony Costello and Vice President Lenny Esposito. From time to time, you'll also hear brief clips from the roundtable event, including Dr. Tuer's voice and Dr. Cronin's voice. In the first half of this discussion, you'll get some helpful background on Dr. Tuer and why he's challenging origin-of-life researchers. The panel also discusses the difficulties inherent in origin-of-life studies, as well as the problems that arise from the models proposed by Lee Cronin. Towards the end of Part 1, the panelists talk about the process of natural selection. How much power do Darwinists believe it has? And just what can the process of natural selection actually do and be credited for? And while Cronin accuses Dr. Tuer of employing a God of the Gaps fallacy in his arguments, the panel explains that it's actually Cronin who employs such a fallacy, more aptly named materialism of the gaps. It's the idea that, given time, science will explain everything, and that we simply need to wait for these natural explanations to come along. And while that's enthusiastic and hopeful, as Brian Miller points out here, every attempt to rationalize away the evidence of design through some natural process eventually collapses as science advances. Now, enjoy this first hour of a stimulating discussion about a fascinating debate over an important scientific question. Just how did the first life on Earth arise?
Okay, everyone, welcome again to the Kirkwood Center podcast for Theology and Ethics. My name is Anthony Costello. I am the president of the Kirkwood Center. I am joined today by Lenny Esposito, my vice president at the Kirkwood Center. And we have an excellent panel put together today. We have some PhD scientists on our panel, some PhD philosophers, to tackle what is, I think, a very significant and controversial issue going on in the natural sciences right now in the area of origin of life research, or what's often called, in this case, abiogenesis. And we're going to be talking about a debate that occurred in November. I believe it was a November 28th debate at Harvard University between the eminent synthetic chemist Jim Tuer and an origin of life researcher by the name of Lee Cronin. Okay. And before we get into that, the issue and what occurred on at that debate, we're going to go through around the panel here and get some introductions. So, Brian Miller, let's start with you. Just give us a short introduction. And then, like I said, we'll go around the horn and have everybody say a little bit of something about who they are and what they do.
Yes, I'm Brian Miller. I have a PhD in complex systems from Duke University. So I had studied a lot about non-equilibrium systems, and that's really how I became interested in the origin of life. And I'm currently a research coordinator at the Discovery Institute and a scientific fellow there.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And actually, let's do all the Discovery Institute guys for it. So we'll go to Casey next. Casey, can you give us a little rundown?
Yeah, my name is Casey Luskin. I'm Associate Director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute, where I work with Brian and Steve Dilley. My role there primarily is I help to direct our research program and also do a lot of advising of scientists and academics who are being persecuted because of their views on intelligent design. And at the moment, my computer is freaking out. I don't know why, but it seems like the control button is permanently pushed down and I can't unstick it. I don't know what's going on. So,
well, you're coming in loud and clear. So I guess it's not
affecting the audio.
Just use a hammer, Casey.
I would really like to right now. I'd like to go Office Space on it, actually.
All right. Well, Steve, let's do you next, since you're colleagues with Brian and Casey at the Discovery.
Yes. My name's Steve Dilley, PhD in philosophy. Been with Discovery for 2 years. I'm a senior fellow and the Academic Center's mentoring coordinator. In a past life, I taught philosophy at a university and have since transitioned to Discovery. So fantastic to be part of the team.
Okay. And Owen Anderson at Arizona State University, who I also think you and Steve have a connection.
Yeah. It's great to see Steve again. We went to graduate school together in philosophy, and I'm now a professor of philosophy and religious studies at Arizona State. And I do some work in philosophy of science. And so I'm excited to be here today and talk about this debate and some of the ideas that came out of him.
Yeah.
Laughing a little bit because I'm looking forward to examining some of the things that were said there.
Yeah, indeed. And as we show some of these clips and go through it, I think there is reason to sort of chuckle at.
I'm only a humble philosopher, but
yeah. Well, it's great. Again, we got two people with science backgrounds and two with academic philosophical backgrounds here. So I think this is going to be super relevant to what we saw on November 28th, where there was clearly an intersection of science and philosophy going on there. And we have to touch on some of those issues. Okay. So Brian and Casey, I kind of want to start with you guys to set up the audience before we get into the debate proper. I want you guys to give us maybe a little bit of history, a little background story on what is going on. What is the origin of life research in this context? Who is Jim Tour? And what has he been doing recently to sort of kind of upset the apple cart here within this origin of life research community? So I don't know who wants to start. Casey or Brian, you want to jump in and maybe give us some background?
Brian is the expert on the origin of life, much more than I am. So I think Brian should tee the ball for us here.
Certainly. And just to give you some background is Jim Tour is one of the world leading researchers on how to create nanoscale machines that perform such actions as killing cancer cells or attacking bacteria or many other purposes. So he is considered an ultimate expert in how do you actually go about creating a very complex molecule that can perform some task, like a molecule that looks like a car that can drive along a track. And several years ago, he started to hear about origin of life research and the claims by the field. And essentially, the challenge of origin of life is explaining how simple chemicals on the early Earth could have come together and coalesced in these very complex molecular machines. And he realized, reading the research of these professors, that their claims were a bit exaggerated, because he knows how hard it is to create a molecule for a purpose, a very specified molecule. And what he realized is the way these researchers were doing it was they were using extremely complex laboratory protocols, multi-steps, changing conditions in a highly orchestrated way. So he realized, but from his expertise, that this could never have any parallel on the early Earth.
Nobody has ever made these compounds with the absolute stereochemical purity that's needed using prebiotic chemistry. Never been done. Nobody has ever shown that the mixtures found in meteorites or interstellar space could be useful for synthesis. Nobody has solved the mass transfer problem. This is a big problem. How much material do you need to go from A all the way to Z, the cell? How much material? You go through a synthesis, you run out of material. You got to go back and make more starting material. You've been going along now 400 million years making stuff. Now you've run out of material. Well, go back and make more in the beginning. I can't go back because I never kept a laboratory notebook. I'm just a dumb early Earth.
And he realized that the key scientific issues related to the origin of life were never being addressed. Like, how do you actually create the building blocks of life, like amino acids and nucleotides, in sufficiently high concentrations and purities that would allow them to come together in a useful way? Also, no one is addressing, even if you had the high concentrations of these molecules, how do they form into long complex chains? And how do they gain the right information to perform the right functions? And finally, he realized they were never addressing, even if you had all these little molecular machines and building blocks, how could they come together in a coherent fashion to maintain a functional cell? So he's basically done a series of videos explaining how Origin of Life researchers have not addressed these key issues, and they're not even on the right track.
Yeah, right. Casey, do you have anything to add that, you know, you've seen over the last couple of years as Jim Tour has been challenging these Origin of Life researchers? Anything else you want to add to what Brian just said?
Sure, yeah. I mean, Jim Tour has also gotten into a number of entanglements with sort of popular expositors of the Origin of Life, the pro-Origin of Life view. I think Brian mentioned that Jim is a professor of chemistry at Rice University. So he really is a renowned chemist. He's published hundreds and hundreds of peer-reviewed papers. He's very well respected in the scientific community as an inorganic synthetic. Actually, I'm sorry, not as an inorganic, but as a synthetic chemist, he is really an expert on how to make things. And he's done some fascinating research producing these nanomachines that actually can drill holes through cell walls to help target cancerous cells or antibiotic resistant cells. And he's really done groundbreaking work in a number of different fields, looking at trying to produce better methods of creating graphene, which is a carbon form of carbon that can help many materials applications. So, you know, he's quite world renowned. So when he decided to enter this Origin of Life debate, he got a lot of attention from folks like Professor Dave, who is a well-known YouTuber, who is sort of a materialist and an expositor of the pro-Origin of Life view. So as Brian mentioned, he's making these videos, and he's also attracted attention from detractors. And so back in May of 2023, Jim did a debate with Professor Dave at Rice University. Jim actually helped to host that. It was quite a fiery debate. I'm sure we can talk about that a little bit more, but I think we covered this debate extensively on evolutionnews.org at Discovery Institute, having some reviews of what the different parties said. In that debate, basically, Jim Tour came and focused strictly on the science. And Professor Dave came and focused strictly on Jim Tour, attacking Jim Tour personally with really an unending series of vicious personal attacks, going after Jim in just the most vicious, nasty personal ways. I think the consensus about everybody on the internet is that whether or not you agreed with Jim Tour, you know, at least he came and focused on the science. And Professor Dave really came simply to attack Jim Tour personally and said that he would enjoy doing so. So it kind of exposes where his, where he is at, you know, wherever he's coming from. Is it's all about attacking people, more than anything else. So I think that when we saw this debate or this roundtable that Jim Tour had with Lee Cronin at Harvard University, we were really interested to know, well, how is this going to go? Is this going to be similar to the Jim Tour Dave Farina debate where a lot of fireworks were going off? Or is it going to be more civil, subdued, et cetera? And I was very pleased to see that actually the roundtable at Harvard where Jim Tour dialogued with Lee Cronin was much more civil and thoughtful, and I would say focused on the issues. Now, that having been said, I and we'll talk about this more. I do think that ultimately, you know, the debate dynamic was not entirely different, in that Jim Tour came to the roundtable at Harvard focused on the science, and ultimately, you know, his opponent spent a lot of time talking about Jim Tour and the rhetorical dynamics of that debate rather than actually answering Jim Tour's questions. But I want to say this. I think that Jim Tour has posed a lot of very credible scientific challenges to the Origin of Life community, and asking reasonable questions about whether or not they are going to be able to explain how the Origin of Life took place. And his questions really have focused on how do you create the key biological molecules that must somehow be synthesized under prebiotic Earth conditions. We're talking about polypeptides, polynucleotides, and polysaccharides. And then he also asks, how do you account for the origin of specified information in those molecules? And then how do you assemble all those components into what he calls an integrated functional living system? under natural, primitive, Earth-like conditions. And I want to say one thing, although Brian really is much more the expert in this topic, he's got a PhD in physics, and he's, you know, he really understands the thermodynamics behind the origin of life and what really goes into these questions. I actually do have a bit of a background myself. When I was an undergraduate student at UC San Diego, I had the opportunity to actually take seminars from Stanley Miller, who was at the very tail end of his career at that time at UC San Diego. A lot of sort of, you know, folks that are in the twilight of their careers like to go to San Diego for their end stages of retirement for obvious reasons. And so San Diego, UC San Diego attracted scientists like Stanley Miller or Francis Crick or Leslie Orgel. And I had the opportunity to hear seminars from these amazing origin of life researchers as a student there, and also took courses from Jeffrey Betta, who was one of the proteges of Stanley Miller. And he was actually my professor, and I learned origin of life from him in a course. So, you know, I do have a bit of a background in this, and I felt very blessed to have been able to study from some of these folks. And so I hope to be able to share a little bit about, you know, unfortunately, their ideas about the primordial soup are kind of outdated these days. But, you know, still it's relevant to the conversation.
All right, great. You know, Steve and Owen, I don't want to leave you guys out of just these initial thoughts here. So if you guys want to jump in, feel free to jump in before we get to some more specific questions.
What we all want, if you don't mind, one thing I stood out to me was the dynamic was not scientific. It was, you seem angry, Tour seems angry, he's being kind of mean, and on Tour's side, he was just saying, look, this science doesn't back up the claims you're making. And so Cronin didn't really address that. He just addressed more the attitude he thought was there or the style of presenting it. So I was a little disappointed in terms of a scientific debate. Philosophically, I thought it had a lot of fascinating things which Peter Kreft brought out. And one of those is what has already been mentioned. And I remember, maybe I'm old, because it seems like we're having the same discussion that was had when I was an undergraduate, and I read books by guys like Paul Johnson, and the Uri Miller experiment makes a number of assumptions about what the origin of life was like, and it conducts that in a laboratory where you can set up all of the outcomes that you'd like. It doesn't know if was that really what the origin of life was like. Is that really what early Earth was like? And so it seems like we're just back to those same conversations. Maybe guys like Cronin didn't know that those conversations have already happened. But what I loved was when Tour said, this actually isn't Uri Miller. It's not even Darwin. It's the Babylonian story of the origin of life.
That was a brilliant line.
I was that was just beautiful. Yeah. And not only did the humans come out of the primordial ooze, so did the Babylonian gods. And he made his comment, do you want them also?
Yeah.
And so it's just fascinating to see. It's not even just going back to the 90s and Paul Johnson. It's going back to the anti-biblical worldview all the way back to Babylon. And I was really impressed that he caught that.
Boy, I kind of want to jump into something right away because, you know, one of the, I think, the underlying issue for me as I watched the whole thing three times, this is just all about causality, right? This is the philosophical question of causation, you know, and is throughout the whole thing. And, you know, there's almost sort of a pantheistic kind of claims being made about, you know, matter, you know, and we'll get into that in more detail.
I mean,
I think the reference to the Babylonian gods themselves coming out of the primordial ooze as if the primordial ooze itself has causal powers.
What you just said is, I think, right on. Yeah. And I've been noticing it in another area where I work in, which is analyzing Marxism. And I just had a really interesting debate with a theologian who lives in Taiwan talking about Chinese Marxism and how it is materialistic and pantheistic.
Right.
And so when Cronin says I'm a materialist, we might think about like an Epicurean who says there's just these atoms and the void. But they really believe, the Marxists and then these same guys in biology, that matter somehow moves itself.
Yeah.
And that's why when Kreft was asking about where does the cause come from? It can't be from inside. Yeah, I think that was him at the dinner table.
Right.
It can't be from the inside. It has to be from the outside. They don't agree with that. They might think that matter has some kind of life force.
Yeah, Steve, anything there that you want to comment on?
Yeah, just big picture. I mean, we can get into the details in a bit here. But there are a lot of things about the debate that I found quite interesting. One of them is, I think, sort of picking up on the conversation here already, it was for me a fascinating window into the mind of a gentleman like Lee Cronin, who's a committed materialist, and who's very irenic, who's intelligent, who has a strong spirit of collaboration and an interdisciplinary sensitivity to him. He really wants to get what he sees as the collective community of science together to move forward to produce what he regards as breakthrough technologies that will help solve some of these problems. And all of that, I think, anchored on some really deep materialist commitments. I think, as Owen's pointing out, we need to probe what those are. And that's an interesting conversation. But I guess one big picture element for me is the debate was a fascinating invitation into a very particular kind of worldview, which in one way is quite winsome and inviting, and in some other ways, I think, is troubling and problematic.
Okay. And I want to mention something. I said Paul Johnson a minute ago. I was thinking, because I've just finished rereading his Intellectuals, I meant Jonathan Wells. I don't know why I confuse those two. And Icons of Evolution. And that has a great chapter about the Uri Miller experiment and how misleading it is in the way it's presented in textbooks. And that's something else that stood out to me, was just when Jim Tours gave examples of what the public thinks and the reality of what science can do. So the public thinks science has made frogs in a laboratory.
Right.
And he says, we're not even close to that.
Okay.
But they're okay with that kind of misleading because they think they're going to get there. And so it doesn't bother them.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get into Jim Tours' opening talk then. Okay.
And Tony, can we give just a little bit more background on what's going on here too?
Sure.
And I can answer your question as well. So just a little bit of background. After the Tour Farina debate, which was in May of 2023, a few months later, Jim Tour, I think this was in August of 2023, Jim Tour posted on his YouTube channel what he called the 60-day challenge to the 10 top Origin of Life researchers, where he basically asked them a series of questions about how various key biological molecules arose, and asking, can you explain how, again, polypeptides, polynucleotides, polysaccharides, how those arose under natural Earth-like conditions? How do you get the specified information in those molecules? And then how do they assemble into a living cell? And he challenged 10 leading Origin of Life theorists to answer those questions. Well, after 60 days, then, you know, a couple months later, I think at the beginning of November, he then put out another YouTube video where he said, okay, 60 days went by. Nobody answered my questions. And Jim actually offered to take down all of his videos challenging the Origin of Life if anybody could answer any of those questions, all right? Well, nobody even tried to answer those questions, which is not unexpected. This is exactly what happened in the Tour Farina debate. Farina didn't even attempt to answer any of Jim Tour's very reasonable questions. But what Jim did announce at the end of those 60 days is that Lee Cronin had agreed to do a roundtable about these questions and have a conversation. And as Steve Dilley just said, major kudos to Lee Cronin for doing this. I think that even though Lee Cronin ultimately also did not answer any of Jim's questions during the roundtable, the very fact that he was willing to enter into a dialogue, and it was a very civil dialogue, you could see that Lee Cronin is a reasonable guy. He's called, I believe, the Regius Chair of Chemistry in the School of Chemistry at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. So, you know, he's a very credible, legitimate Origin of Life theorist. You can tell that he's a winsome, congenial, civil guy, thoughtful person. You know, he didn't come there looking to get nasty, and I think everybody appreciated that. And you could, you know, he's also very charismatic. I mean, you want to follow somebody like, you know, Lee Cronin off the edge of a cliff. I don't know if that's where he's leading us or not, but he's a very charismatic guy. He's got a great haircut too, kind of like Lenny. You know, he's somebody who is a very winsome personality, and that's to his credit. So anyway, I just want to give that background here on what was going on and what led up to this roundtable.
Yeah. Unlike Farina, who actually even attacked the audience, Farina even said, all you people don't even know what the science is. Nobody
seems with to a couple of expletives thrown in as
Farina,
well.
And Farina's not a degreed, you know, he doesn't have a PhD in this field. So it was interesting. But yeah, to your point, I think it's important for us to realize it's not that nobody could put forth a model that integrates all of these fives. It's nobody can offer an answer to any of those five. And it seems to me that, you know, there's not even a starting point, is what he's saying. So,
yeah, well, you know, for myself, maybe I've been in different kinds of debates than everyone since I'm a philosopher and I do theological debates also. I actually like when someone is just aggressive and upfront.
Yeah,
I don't like the winsome approach because it feels duplicitous and it feels like they're trying to use charisma to slip something past the audience. And so what I was paying attention to was when things came up like, I'm a materialist. Okay, good. That's what I want to know. And sometimes if the winsomeness can sometimes hide that stuff. But that's why I felt like there was the whole thing was a kind of Mott and Bailey fallacy, which was on the front end, you don't want to do technology? Technology is great. I want to do technology. Okay, so life began through purely materialist causations. What? Wait a minute. And so I felt like that kept going on over and over. And Peter Kreft called it out as a philosopher. He saw that was going on and said, wait, we're talking about science or technology? Those are different things. So I understand the point you're making. It's always nice to have someone who's kind in debate. I don't like being yelled at in debate, but I do like clarity. I do like when someone just says, I think you're wrong. I'm a materialist. I think only chunks of atoms exist.
Well, I tell you, and maybe this is just me. This is just a personality thing. I think you guys are really charitable, more charitable than I. I thought Cronin had some only very thinly veiled insults for both Jim Tour and Peter Kreft when he said at the panel discussion towards the end, like, just hold on, wait, and you might learn something.
Yeah.
Or so, like to Peter Kreft, as if
it
Peter
did feel
Kreft
condescending.
Was just some, you know, dude off the street who hasn't written like 100 books in philosophy, 20 of which I have upstairs, you know, and some other things too. I thought the animus, maybe not animus is a strong word, but I thought the contempt was really just under the surface. That's the way I saw a lot of the interactions at the dinner table and the panel discussion. Yeah,
I have a
beware. But I want to now. I know Casey wants to get. I want to get back to Brian on some of the more substantive scientific issues. But go ahead, Casey. Let's get you in.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Get Brian in there.
Okay.
It's fine, yeah.
So Brian, I mean, I'd play clips here, but I want to just keep it going. Let's dig in now to Tour's opening talk, which included the challenge. You know. There's an accusation that the Origin of Life researchers have not been on the up and up with their results. Okay, that's clear. And I think that's a huge issue, right? That's an ethics issue. And then there's, okay, and here's why. Here are like, what, you know, he says these four or five things that need to happen if you're going to make any kind of claims like this. So take us a little bit into Tour's challenge to the OOL researchers and why they're failing to sort of make advances here.
Certainly. And I'll give you a little bit more of a preface of what is really Origin of Life research. Because if you look at what Origin of Life researchers do, all the experiments can be summarized in three, most of it can be summarized in three different buckets. One is they take gases on the early Earth. They then will maybe apply a few other materials that were available, and they apply some energy source, like an electric charge, which would mimic lightning. Then what happens, they look at the results, and they say, aha, we've got amino acids. Aha, we've got some other molecule that's useful for life. But what Jim Tour has pointed out, and what other Origin of Life researchers have pointed out, like Stephen Benner, is what you have is every molecule useful for life, like an amino acid, is surrounded by many other molecules. And what happens is that's really where every Origin of Life theory fails. That's where it ends. Now, the next challenge, which Tour brought out, is, okay, let's just assume that you've got all the molecules you want in pure form in high concentrations, like all the amino acids you want. And the challenge is when you try to link them together in chains in the right way, because they have to have the right bonds, when you look at experiments like those performed by Lee Cronin, and that's one of the experiments that Jim Tour has brought out, is what you get is essentially junk. You have these amino acids that link together, but they often link together in the wrong way. In addition, what happens is they don't contain the right sequence, the right information to do anything useful.
The carbohydrate, just think of it, six glucose molecules. How can you hook them together? AAAAAA, for example. No, you can hook them together in over 1 trillion ways because there's all these different tentacles of how they can hook up. Nobody has solved the polymer stability problem when dealing with the single molecules. Time is enemy number one. And Martin Nowak helped me calculate this on the back of a menu about a year ago. And nobody has solved the problem with this functional group side chain. This kills off all polymerizations of amino acids to make polypeptides. Nobody solved that. Nobody has solved the code problem. What's the genetic code? How do you come up with the code for life? You have to have prescribed code to orient all these. Nobody knows where that comes from.
And another problem that Tour has pointed out and others have pointed out, if you were to, let's say, take the output of these experiments and you were to drop them in an ocean in the ancient Earth, or you put them in a little pool, what would happen is those molecules would simply break apart. So that's the challenge that Tour was presenting. And what he said is when you look at Lee Cronin's research, his earlier research attempted to look at the chemistry, but it all failed. He didn't produce anything useful. So now what's happened is Lee Cronin is looking at these more abstract mathematical models like assembly theory. And that's right. Kind of the third bucket of research. And when you look at that research, what happens is it's completely detached from the real world. It doesn't in any way model the real chemistry. So that's the point that Tour made, is that he made a prediction. He said, I predict when Lee Cronin gives you his talk, he will give you no solutions to the problems I've mentioned. He'll tell you nothing about how the chemistry could have moved a molecular system towards life. And he'll give you no knowledge of how life could have originated. And that's exactly what happened in the debate.
If I could add something else, yeah. There was also sort of a science communication criticism that Jim Tour levied. Brian did a great job explaining the scientific challenges that Jim Tour posed. And this was alluded to earlier, I believe, that Jim Tour is really concerned that original life theorists are overstating what has been accomplished to the public. And so, for example, I think Owen mentioned that he talked about the fact that a very large percentage of the public believes that people have made frogs in the lab or made life in the lab. And these are based upon surveys of people's beliefs about the origin of life. And so why does the public have these totally mistaken beliefs? Of course, that has never happened. Nobody has produced life in the lab. Nobody has shown how you can produce life under simulated natural early Earth conditions. And so why do people believe this? Well, Jim Tour gives quotes in many of his videos, and he did this a little bit at the roundtable, including one from Lee Cronin, of people saying that they have produced life in the lab. Or he has a quote from Lee Cronin back in 2011 saying that he's going to produce life in the lab within 2 years. Okay. So yep. There's a reason why the public believes this. And it's because leading origin of life theorists are going around saying that people have produced life in the lab. And then you also look at the textbooks. The textbooks make these claims. In fact, sometimes Jim will show a large stack of textbooks that are promoting the sort of false view that say the primordial soup theory helped to solve the origin of life. Do you know where those textbooks come from? This is my wall of biology textbooks, you guys. And a while back, Jim contacted me and asked me to come up with a list of textbooks and take a picture of them for him, of textbooks that are basically making false claims about the primordial soup model and this idea that life emerged from this soupy mixture on the early Earth. And of course, this is now widely even disregarded by the origin of life community. But so I had a staff member and I, we went through a bunch of textbooks. We sent Jim a nice photo of a big stack of them. And these are literally the textbooks from my wall of biology textbooks here in my office. And so it's no wonder that the public has these false beliefs when they're being told by leading theorists and in the textbooks they're reading that the origin of life question has essentially been resolved. And so Jim's point really is that the origin of life theorist needs to tone down its rhetoric. The field as a whole needs to be very honest and open about the fact that they have not resolved these questions. To Lee Cronin's credit, although I do agree with many of the accusations that he was kind of shifty sometimes and trying to get you to believe the origin of life solution is within our grasp without actually providing anything remotely close to a solution. It was all about believe, 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 just have faith, follow my charisma to the ends of the earth. But, I think that nonetheless, at least he acknowledged during the roundtable that we don't have a solution. And I think that that is a true statement. And so one of Jim's best arguments he made during his opening statement, which by the way was 100% focused on the science, he didn't shout, he didn't get angry, he kept his cool and as calm. It was a great opening statement that Jim made during this roundtable. But Jim made this point that each advance that is made in the origin of life chemistry field, it may solve one small little problem. But meanwhile, our knowledge of the complexity of the cell keeps increasing at a much greater pace, meaning that the prospect of a solution to the origin of life is continually receding, as Jim puts it. So the problem keeps getting worse. As Tor said, he said, we learn a little bit about chemistry. We learn a lot about the cell, and the prospect of solving how the cell or the origin of life might have evolved and originated naturally just keeps getting further and further away from us the more that we discover. And I thought that was a very good framing that Jim put on the question.
And what you just said, Casey, is exactly why the book Icons of Evolution came to mind, which is the biology textbooks continue to use misleading information that favors a materialist philosophical outlook. And that's where I felt it was more like a apologist for materialism, Cronin was, than just a scientist. And so when he's going after Tour and saying, why are you being mean? It's like, I'm not sure it is mean. I didn't read him as being mean at all. Just saying you don't have any proof. Which is what a scientist should want. And then kind of just saying, well, we should be optimistic. You know, we want to be friendly to future studies. We don't want to shut down future studies. Well, but we want to know what the studies are and if they should be funded. I thought that was why funding was important. And it was kind of funny to me the amounts of money being thrown around, because I know at somewhere like Harvard, $50 million is nothing. But to the rest of us, $50 million, well, maybe, I don't know about you in California, $50 million is just nothing. In Arizona, that's still a lot of money. House.
Well, that, you know, that line
of rhetoric. Yeah, and so when someone says, what would you do with $50 million? As if you got to do something with it versus, well, it was given by donors or taxpayers under false pretenses. They were told you're just about to make life, and if you just give another $50 million, you'll push us over the goalpost. And it's not true. And so the money may not be there to spend in the first place.
You know, let me just as a point of reference here in Jim Tour's opening talk, he referenced Jack Sostak, who made a 2014 claim about how he was going to be able to create life in the lab. And then Cronin made a claim in 2011 about making life in the lab. So, there's a lot here because to add on to Owen's last point, I thought a lot of Cronin's rhetoric about what science is and how we do science and problems is having problems, is how we advance, you know, and having disagreements is how we advance. I thought that was a lot of just hand waving, to be honest, to get away from this more serious ethical charge, I think, or ethical accusation that Tour's making, that the public has been deceived in a sense.
That's a big deal.
And you know, my father was an academic engineer for 40 years at the University of Notre Dame. I talked to him on occasion. He was department chair, and he talks about what people will do to get funding. I mean, I don't want to make any strong claim there, but I mean, I think we have to take into account that, you know, people are people. Egos are at work here.
Well, we all talk about transparency with the government.
Yeah,
and I think we're hopefully transitioning to a time where we're going to require transparency with universities also.
Yeah,
and how they spend their money and the claims they make. I think there's, and what we actually get.
I think there's also a presupposition of combinatorialism, that the idea is if I can solve this one little piece, then I can just add it to the puzzle. And all we have to do is put all the chains together, which again, Tour said, no, that doesn't work that way, because you have the N plus one problem. What, you know, okay, they come together, but what if they break apart and things like that? So, but there seems to be an assumption. And throughout Cronin's reply to Tour, I got the feeling that he was saying, well, I solved this part, you solved that part, and eventually we'll string them all together. But if you have the wrong presupposition, then it's never going to work.
We're making progress. Someone needs to count up how many times did Lee Cronin say, we're making progress. We're making progress. Okay, that's great. But can you answer any of Jim Tour's questions? That's what I really want to know.
Okay, well, let's go back to Brian. So one of the things that, and Brian, you already touched on this, one of the things that Cronin responded with was assembly theory.
What does assembly theory actually do? So assembly theory tries to tell you, explain how selection is the driving force that produces proto-evolution outside of biology. Selection is the force that produces the star. If you take an object, cut it up with a pair of scissors in your head, you can cut it up to basically minimize the reuse on a graph. Abracadabra, just imagine that. Put it on a graph. You then count how many copies of the object you have, and the larger the number of copies and the larger the assembly index, the more you're sure it came from evolution. That's the basic premise.
Assembly theory tells us how to detect selection and so on and so forth. And just as another point of reference, Jim Tour has already followed up in a video with Hector Zanil, who I think is an expert in this field, about assembly theory. So Brian and Casey, maybe, and Steve, I don't know if you want to chime in. Assembly theory was Cronin's big thing. This was what he was throwing out there as his response to Tour's challenges. So give us some sense of what assembly theory is and how he's trying to use that.
Sure. And what'll be helpful is to give you a little bit of a background, because what's interesting about this conversation is that Tour is being much more generous about the field than many leaders in the field. Like, there's an amazing paper by Stephen Benner. It's called Paradoxes in the Origin of Life. And in this paper, and again, Stephen Benner is considered one of the leading researchers in the world. It's one of the people that Tour mentioned. And he's absolutely committed to believing it was through a purely natural process. So he's as biased as anyone that it had to be natural. Yet, he stated that all that we know about chemistry and physics and every origin of life research, that's all the research that's been done, point to the fact that the origin of life appears impossible. That's really striking, because the problem is that natural processes will tend to break things down into lower energy and greater disorder. But origin of life requires nature to build things up into systems of high order and high energy. So Steve Benner recognizes that the origin of life appears impossible based on the science. But at the end of the paper, what he says is we have to assume it happened. Essentially, don't give up the faith. We'll figure something out. That's really striking. Another paper that's similar is by Michael Russell, who's another leader of the field. His paper is called Frankenstein or a Submarine Alkaline Vent, Who is Responsible for Abiogenesis? And it was in BioEssays. And he says in his paper that everything that happens in life happens because a machine makes it happen. Every reaction, every process only happens because complex machinery in the cell forces it to happen. And he says that the possibility of simple chemistry and energy inputs on the early Earth producing anything useful to life appears impossible. So that's really striking. And what's interesting is if you look at Sarah Walker, and Sarah Walker is one of the people that was on the assembly paper. She's one of the authors. Right. She did a beautiful paper with Paul Davies. So I actually have a lot of respect for Paul Davies and Sarah Walker. They're very insightful.
ASU?
Yes.
Little plug.
Oh, there you go. And they said in The Hard Problem of Life that you have to worry about information. Information is key, because physics and chemistry can't simply explain life. You need information. And they talk about how to explain this, it can't be explained by the normal laws of physics. They say to explain the causal power of information, causal purchase, they say, we have to imagine completely different physics. That's striking. So when Sarah Walker joined Lee Cronin, it's really interesting, because Lee Cronin before did this chemistry experiments trying to figure out how molecules could form into molecular machines or polypeptides. But now assembly theory has nothing to do with chemistry. And what's interesting is the logic of assembly theory is pretty much the same as Bill Dembski's design detection filter, the design inference. His paper, Lee Cronin's paper, is essentially a method for detecting design. And to detect design, you have to describe two things. One, you have to look at the probability of something occurring. Like, what's the probability that a bunch of letters in your alphabet soup will come together in a certain sequence? But also, you have to think about how are certain patterns special? How are they specified? And when you have both something improbable and something that is some way specified or special, it points to design. So what's interesting in Lee Cronin's paper is he's using the exact same logic, but instead of saying design, he's saying natural selection.
Yes.
So he appeals to natural selection, not as a real process, because as Stephen Benner said in his paper, that I mentioned, Paradox is in the Origin of Life, it appears theoretically impossible for nucleotides or amino acids to come together and have the right information because you just need too many trials and you couldn't possibly have that many trials on the early Earth. That's very striking. But Lee Cronin isn't talking about natural selection as a real process, but more it's like a secular demigod. So what's interesting about assembly theory is you look at the mathematics, and part of his assembly index is simply the inverse of the probability of some complex systems coming together in the simplest way possible, and part of it is its specialness. And the specialness is simply the number of copies you see, because the logic is you see more copies of the same thing, it's more special. And he would say it's because natural selection acted more. So that's what's so striking about his paper, is it really reflects Sarah Walker, who knows that information is essential. She knows there's something special with life. But what happens, instead of using design language, they simply use the language of natural selection.
Steve, Owen, you guys want to jump in on that? A lot to say about how he was using the word selection.
Yeah, I do want to pick up that point in a moment. But also, just reflect for a moment in light of what Brian's saying on what I would say is the rhetorical challenge for somebody like Jim Tour in this context. And in light of his dialogue with Lee, and for that matter, Lee Cronin's rhetorical challenge too, I think part of the challenge is one of the things that both Cronin and Tour are looking at is specified complexity. The sequence of amino acids, nucleotide bases, and so on. So one of the points of data is what Brian, Casey, I, and others in the intelligent design movement would regard as compelling evidence of design. Right. But what's difficult for Jim Tour in particular is he says explicitly that he thinks it's probably the case that there will be a natural origin to life, or he doesn't mean that naturalistically in the sense that God was not involved. He means what we call it like a secondary process.
Secondary
causation. God's primary activity, but him perhaps setting up the universe and orchestrating the advent of the first life on Earth in a way that doesn't require direct miraculous intervention. Okay, so I think part of the challenge is Tour is saying, look, there are these unsolved problems. But he thinks some natural process or set of processes will eventually come to light that is the correct path in which life unfolded. And I think the challenge is if you say that on the one hand, and then part of the data you're looking at on the other hand is this sequence of highly specific, highly complex strings of genetic information, say, in every cell, or what was necessary in the first cell, then you have the difficulty of the one hand of what seeming to be good evidence of, we might say, direct design, and on the other hand, still a commitment that some as of yet undiscovered natural processes will account for that. So that's a difficulty, I think, for the overall picture that Jim has in mind. And if that's presented to somebody like Cronin, I can understand him saying, in so many words, look, we both agree that natural processes will be uncovered. And as soon as you make that move, I think you don't have to attend quite so much to things like sequence specificity, that assembly theory really is a mode of design detection. And in effect, although I think Jim was correct to point out many of the problems, I think his deeper or part of his commitment or hope or belief that we'll have a natural account ends up, I think, conceding significant ground to Cronin just saying, well, I do too. And I just think we're at an earlier stage, and maybe Cronin should have been more explicit with the public and so on about where we're at. But in a sense, you have deep agreement on a deep issue that I think that mitigates or shades the clear evidence of design that is right there. And that I think that shifts the whole contour of the debate in a significant way that doesn't help, frankly, a kind of robust case for what Jim is ultimately after.
Well, I think it's interesting to really listen very, very carefully to what Jim said. And I've been listening to this very carefully and have been on his podcast and so forth. And because Jim has said, okay, I will play by your rules. I'll just kind of look at natural processes. I'm not going to think about anything outside of that box. He's agreed to play in their playing field, so to speak. But when you hear him speak, he talked about he's sympathetic towards people looking for design arguments. He's sympathetic to people looking for ways to measure design. But he says, I don't have a way in my lab to measure design. I can't take a spectroscope or I can't take a chemical protocol and detect design. So yes, he's absolutely right. I totally agree with him that he can't detect design because that's not what he does. He's an organic chemist. But he says he's sympathetic to people looking at those measures. And I think it's really striking that Bill Dembski just came out with his new book, the second edition of Design Inference, which gives exactly what Tor is talking about. But Tor recognizes that he's not an expert in mathematics or philosophy, so that's not his thing. He's operating in the playing field that he's trained to operate in and obeying the rules that they've told him he has to obey to be part of the conversation. So I think that's right. A good thing to think about in the background.
Now, that's a great point, because when he mentioned that, I think it was towards the end of the panel discussion, that he didn't have a tool to detect design. I immediately thought of, well, I have the signed copy upstairs, I think, thanks to Casey for that, of the second edition of Design Inference.
Where you get into kind of methodological naturalism.
Naturalism. You're right.
I think that's where Peter Kreft was the only one who had the tools.
Right.
To speak into this. And I mean, also he's just kind of a senior scholar. Even if you disagree with him on a lot of things, he's a notable scholar who's been in the academy a long time. Yeah. So I thought Cronin should have had some deference to him for that reason, that okay, he's trying to make
Just Cronin, but some of the others at the table as well. I mean, yeah. That Melissa Franklin, I don't want to be at a dinner with her necessarily.
The point about science and technology is really important here.
Yeah.
And a lot of the philosophical materialists' claims piggyback on supposed advances in technology. And those, you'll always see this again as a modern Bailey fallacy where they'll say, don't you like cell phones? Therefore, we create life in a petri dish. I don't want to lose my cell phone, so I guess I better believe that. And so, or cancer research was maybe one brought up, right? You don't like cancer. No, I hate cancer. Well, you got to believe life started in petri dishes then. And so you'll always have this going on. I thought that he called that out real well. And added an additional problem for the materialist, which is, okay, even you like technological advances, why? Toward what goal do they aim? Yeah, that's a very Aristotelian question.
Yeah.
And the naturalist, the contemporary naturalist, has gotten rid of everything except for efficient causation.
They don't have a larger final
causation. They can't answer that.
Yeah, this is a larger problem, I think, in society where, and we talk about scientism a lot, but even Hawking and Mladenov in their book, I mean, in his first page, he says how philosophy is dead and the physicist is now reigning and he'll answer the questions of tomorrow. And there does seem to be a hubris, in folks who have steeped themselves so much in the science that they think that the advances that you talk about, and they're important advances. I mean, everybody recognizes.
But with every advance like that, the utopian technological story has a realistic dystopian 20th century.
That's right.
So for every time you say, "Well, don't you like this?" Yeah, but we also live through the 20th century,
which is. I mean, that was even Mary Shelley's point in writing the modern Prometheus. Right? It's the idea is again, what are you advancing? And if you're advancing human betterment, then we still have to bring in the virtues, and we still have to look to philosophy. Yep. We can't just dismiss it.
Let's stick on the philosophical issue here, because one thing that frustrated me, and Brian and Steve already sort of touched on this, was the way that Cronin was using the word selection as, I think, Brian, you said, a sort of a secular demigod.
Was capitalized by Darwin, right?
Yeah, S with the capital S. That
as if it's a person that does things.
Powers, it does things. You know, it does all kinds of things. But then later in the talk, he almost scolds Peter Kreft, where he says, well, look, it's not magic that we're talking about. And I'm like, you know, it kind of is. It's your own version of magic, if you want to
put it. You have that Thor meme. Isn't it, though?
Yeah. So, Steve, you mentioned in your email that you want to talk a little bit about the idea of mind here, because it just really seemed to me that Cronin, and not just Cronin, but the others at the table. I mean, this is she a physicist? I believe her name was Melissa Franklin. She was on the panel, you know, and she made some really offhanded remarks about the Little Prince and, you know, this idea that these theists just believe in magic. I mean, there was again, it was thinly veiled.
She also introduced me to something I didn't know about. She interrupted at one point and said, "It's okay if I interrupt because I have ADHD. And I normally have a card that I hand out that explains this." And I was thinking to myself, this is great. I didn't know I could do that.
Yeah, that was strange. And I tell you, her last comment to Tor, that was, I mean, it wasn't even a veiled insult where he just, the camera was on Tor and he just looked over at the moderator like, I don't even know, where she kind of said to him, because we know how interested you are in people not lying about me or not telling the truth about things. And so she was fairly aggressive there. But, you know, there was this making fun. I felt, at least my impression, was this sort of like Lenny said, we're the physicists at the table. We're the scientists. And you sort of philosophers, at least with regards to Krafft, you know, let us tell you sort of how the world works. And Krafft did. He brought up a point about external, you know, intrinsic causation versus there's some other external force, supernatural force, acting on material objects.
So I predict that Lee Cronin, a synthetic chemist, will not discuss anything tonight about chemical reactions leading to life's origin. I predict Lee Cronin will remain silent on polypeptides, polynucleotides, polysaccharides, these three key polymers that build us. And cell assembly, resorting to calling those narrow questions and not worth even addressing.
Since we know that cells came after molecules, some other force than the molecules themselves must have moved them. Now, that force must be external to molecules, and it must be either outside of molecules in the environment, or it must be some force outside the universe, right?
We don't know that. Everything on Earth is pretty much touched by biology in some way. We don't know that every planet in the sky around the sun, life doesn't emerge eventually. Jim, I don't really know what your agenda is. I don't know who your audience is. I came here tonight hoping you weren't going to get up there and shout and misquote. And I refuse to get in that conversation. I came here in good faith. I'm only going to take part in the panel interview if we actually really put away our let's just make statements for claims and actually ask, well, what is interesting? What do you find confusing? Where are the new problems?
And, you know, but so it was it was frustrating to me that Cronin was using what I would call agentive language for these material for selection, as if it was an agent. But then he wanted to scold the, you know, Krafft and others for, as if they're talking about magic. You know.
Yeah, and going... And that point makes me think about the Greek word nous, and the Greek scientists and philosophers, materialists, all debated this exact idea. Where does mind exist? Is it in physical objects? Does it motivate them to do things? Is it external to them? So for me, watching this debate, it was again, and that's why I thought it was so brilliant that Tor brought up Babylonian mythology. Yeah. This stuff's been discussed before, and Cronin may not know that. That's on him. He should know this stuff, and that is why the humanities are important. None of this is new. None of it's due to recent technology, and even last 200 years, the Greeks debated this idea. Ultimately, he found it even in the Babylonian origin stories. And it reminds me of that documentary, Expelled, where Richard Dawkins tells us, God, that's ridiculous. Okay, well, where do you think life came from? Aliens. And it's literally before the alien guy meme. I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens. Richard Dawkins thinks that. That's his solution. And that's, again, the Babylonian solution. Some powerful beings from up there came to Earth and started life here. And so there's nothing new that I'd like to see that engaged with by these scientists. And maybe they can't because they don't have that humanities background. They don't know how to do that.
Well, one thing that's been interesting when I've talked to really high-level scientists is often they really hate talking about philosophy. It's not just that it's something that they don't understand, they don't necessarily think it's valuable, but they feel threatened by it, almost angry. Because what philosophy does is it questions their underlying assumptions about reality. And they have this view of reality that everything is just natural processes. And they hate having that faith commitment challenged because they know if they step out of that framework, the world may look very different from what they expect. And that could be very scary.
Well, what you and Casey have both used that imagery of just believism or faith. And I think that's exactly right. It felt like one of these Hallmark Christmas story movies, just believe and it'll come true. And at the same time, though, they'll make fun of Christian students in their classes for having faith in God. And so it's just sort of like, well, what are you doing different? And it does remind me of the three groups of people Socrates questioned. And these kind of scientists I put in the third group, the tradesmen, meaning they're technicians. They know how to build things, which are very impressive, Socrates said. But at the end of the day, they can't answer Peter Kreft's question, which is really Socrates' question. Why? Why do you do it? What purpose does it serve? Well, it makes my life more comfortable. Yeah, but then you still die. I mean, well, I'll live forever. I think I've read one of my favorite ideas for immortality was Elon Musk saying we're going to download our consciousness into a chip and put it on, store it on a moon of Jupiter. That sounds great. Like, I can't wait to live forever in a computer chip on a moon of Jupiter. Like, why? For what purpose? And they can't answer that question. And that's what Socrates found too. And he, of those three groups, he commended them the most because they do make useful things, but they don't know what purpose it serves.
Steve, let's get you in here.
Yeah, I do think, the question of purposiveness, as Owen's saying, and Brian's earlier point about these deeper philosophical commitments, I think it's quite interesting that somebody like Cronin, who is a committed materialist, when he's describing his theory, or when he's describing the elements of how the theory would help advance origin of life research, as you're pointing out, Tony, he does use this agent-oriented language, the term selection, he uses the term memory. And I think there's a long trend of this. You certainly see this in The Origin of Species, where there's purposive, not just purposive, but agent-like a language that's used of what purport to be natural processes. So Darwin, when he's writing about natural selection, he says it's daily and hourly scrutinizing, adding up all that is good. You know, there's the language of agency that's being attributed to nature. And then at the same time, the audience is asked to discard that language as being purely metaphorical or purely figurative. When the agent language itself is used both for the intelligibility, so we understand what assembly theory means, or what natural selection is, and it's also used for plausibility. Because we know from our first-person experience, we know what it's like for agents to do things. We know from our first-person experience that agents create complex things, bicycles, radios. My kids are into Lego, and so on. So the agent-based language takes what we see of ordinary nature, which in our experience doesn't in and of itself, in our sort of first-person experience, create a lot of complexity. When leaves fall off the trees in my yard, I don't get messages typically. So we attribute what Cronin does.
Typically, I like you qualify that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do, but it's not normal.
Yeah. There's the attribution of something that is based in our own experience produces complexity, but then the quick qualification of no, that's figurative. And in my way of thinking, the use of agent language, which we're asked to take seriously, and then we're also asked not to take seriously at the same time, is a little bit like climbing up a ladder and then claiming that the lower rungs are dispensable. Climbing up the materialist account, using language, the only way we'd find that plausible is if we had reference to mind and what minds do and what agents choose, and then saying, oh, these lower rungs that got us here actually were just purely figurative. They actually didn't, they're not to be taken too seriously. I think rhetorically and frankly epistemologically for somebody like Cronin, that's a very difficult position to be in if you're really going to defend it.
Well, and he said, right, I'm just my brain at one point. We can map our brains. It's just a matter of we don't maybe have the computers that can do it yet, but we'll eventually just be able to map them. And there you are. Now you could duplicate yourself with a software or a downloaded chip of some kind. So I think your point there, Stephen, plus the original one you made about the distinction between primary and secondary causes is the big point. It's a really well taken, which is there's no place for God in their understanding. And so they're okay pushing it back further and further and further and including aliens from other planets, because the idea that God made life doesn't fit into their assumptions. Kind of what Brian just said too. They have to rethink their faith commitment to materialism. And so as long as technology is humming along and producing these benefits, they don't really see a need to. But I do think, I mean, they'd be right if they pointed out, kind of also to Brian's point, that philosophy is not exactly, I mean, we're not producing cell phones for anybody. What have we done lately? But making someone uncomfortable about their presuppositions is kind of like, if we're still doing that, then we are doing what we're supposed to do, which is raise questions and get us to rethink, hey, maybe we don't have the right assumptions. So I think there could be some fear about philosophy for that reason. The scientists would say, look, we've actually helped people. What have the philosophers done?
Well, one of the things that was clear, and Brian, you, Steve, you, and Owen, you guys have all just pointed it out, is in the academic world, there's still this just massive disconnect, right, between the natural sciences and philosophy. I mean, that just has carried over from, I don't know, the 19th century, positivism, whatever.
Well, it's built into the modern research university, I think, because you're supposed to produce things that help society. And that, I think that is one reason. Another part of me is involved in debates about cultural Marxism. And I think that's another reason why that's popular for the humanist, is because they say that's how we can help make society better. We can make a more equitable society because we need to live up to that standard. And classical liberalism doesn't do anything. And so we need to abandon that. So I think that's partly built into the research university model. And just the fact that, on that progress standard, philosophy doesn't really make things, right? Doesn't invent things.
Well, so that's going to change, though, because our technology is running farther and farther than our ethics can
catch. Well, you will see in almost every philosophy department a poster that says famous philosophers, Steve Jobs, right? And it'll list like all these guys. And I always feel it's a little bit, I guess I feel pathetic, like, guys, that makes us look bad, actually, because
I'm thinking more of the engineering department that comes up with Google's driving car and they put it on the road in Arizona. And now you've got Philippa Foot's trolley problem in actuality.
Yeah,
in real life, none of the engineers have ever studied Foot or philosophy and don't know even the questions that they have to deal with. I mean,
but I think it gets something that Steve had mentioned. What we should talk about is God of the gaps, and I think that is what comes up.
Which
we really need God? Can we just fill it in eventually so we don't even need God anymore?
Whatever you want to say, but we move those experiments further. You know, I don't know what's going on here, but I read a lot of David Deutsch, who I think is really at the right interface here. A lot about what Galileo did, and I'm no Galileo, but I do think that there are a segment in society that want to cause the God of the gaps. And I'm sorry, Jim, I actually think you're just trying, there's a God in the gaps. I've looked at it very clearly. You say on one hand, I accept it's going to be solved. And on the other hand, you so vociferously make arguments about, hey, I hate the way science works. When you do that yourself in your own science, be it nanotransistors, new conductors, new catalysts. So you kind of move the goalposts. And I disagree that the problem is getting bigger and the goalposts are moving in the past. That's not what's happening. That is, Jim is very, very nicely playing a sleight of hand here by saying and this and this and this, missing the key shift that has to happen in the discipline.
Right. So Brian wanted to make a point, and then I saw Casey also trying to pipe. So Brian, you wanted to get a word in edgewise as well.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I'll speak anyway. And what I would have said later is it's interesting with God of the gaps, because the logic of it, you know, goes back to Epicurus, Lucretius, this idea that we know the world is just natural processes, just matter in motion, these rules of interactions, chance and time. That's it. So if you say something looks like it's designed in nature, then it's God of the gaps, because it's simply, we don't yet know how a natural process did it. But in reality, when you look at the way the science is progressing, it's really the opposite. You look at evidence of design everywhere in the laws of nature, in our planet, in life, And what happens is every attempt to rationalize away the evidence of design through some natural process, like a multiverse or the RNA world hypothesis or some narrative about how the eye came about, collapses as science advances. So it really is a materialism of the gaps. The truth is the opposite. We see design everywhere, and every attempt to rationalize it away fades as time goes on. And what I mentioned before, how what a lot of Origin of Life people do is they talk about natural selection as a demigod with creative agency. And that's how they rationalize away the evidence of design. But a second demigod is self-organization.
Yeah.
So what you always hear in Origin of Life research is either natural selection, self-organization, emergence, or both. And usually it's both. And that's always where you have essentially a design of the gaps. Where you see evidence of design, we don't want to recognize it, will appeal to self-organization without any intellectual content or natural selection to explain it away.
That's a great point.
And I think one of the other professors at the Harvard professors at the dinner table conversation mentioned self-organization. I think it was one of the older gentlemen on the end.
Well, it connects up with the point about Babylon, because the Babylonian thing is you had chaos and then order emerged. From what? It just does.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly the point, is there's no naturalistic explanation of that, though. It doesn't seem like order emerges out of chaos in any of our experiences.
Well, and Stephen, I mean, we know that, I mean, we're getting spookier and spookier metaphysical theories about matter, right, in the last 30 or 40 years, whether, you know, you talk about like panpsychist theories of particles, subatomic particles having some level or degree or kind of consciousness, conscious life. That I'm starting to move away from the idea of, you know, material versus immaterial language and personal versus impersonal, I think is maybe even a more appropriate way to discuss, the issue of whether or not we think things are, caused by agents or caused by impersonal forces. But Casey, yeah. Steve, why don't you go ahead and then let Casey jump in after that?
Yeah, I think there's a interesting dilemma, because on the one hand, as we've mentioned, Cronin was using agent-like language to describe his theory. There's selection. At some point, I want to return to that, because I think it's fascinating to think about what that might mean. But in any case, he uses terms like selection and memory, which, as we've noted, are mind-based or mind-oriented types of descriptors. And then, on the other hand, as Owen's pointing out, he has a strong materialist view of the mind. And if we take that seriously, then even his own first-person experience or the first-person experience of others is ultimately reduced to efficient causes of matter and motion. So the very language that's used to make his theory intelligible and plausible, agent-based language, it turns out in his own worldview, that would dissolve into purposeless, mindless physical chemical interactions. So when he would lose not only his own mind in the material view, but would lose the very grounds to explain and render plausible his assembly theory when taken on its own terms, when taken on his own worldview in a significant way. So there you have a worldview that I think effectively undermines the evidence that he's citing for a key component of it, assembly theory, the origin of life, and so on. To connect this to your earlier point, whether we describe Cronin as a kind of classical materialist or whether there's some panpsychism or whatever, it does look like his understanding of what minds are and what nature is articulated in a way that significantly undercuts itself.
Yeah, Casey, did you have anything?
Yeah, I'd like to drill down on this conversation we're having about selection, God of the Gaps, and what was mentioned earlier about Jim Tour not supporting intelligent design, which he says he doesn't, and I'll take him at face value with that. But I just want to kind of tie these things together for us. Selection is often used as everybody has been saying, as a magic wand or a demigod or a divine substitute that can do anything you want just when you need it. You need something, then selection can provide it. All right, fine. The problem, this actually applies directly to this conversation we're having about the origin of life. Because the problem is that you can't get selection until you have replication. So in order to get selection, you really need a self-replicating molecule. And nobody ever seemed to address this in the Tuer-Cronin conversation. And in fact, many of origin of life theorists therefore place the origin of life as the origin of this first self-replicating molecule. Because they will say, once we get this self-replicating molecule, then we can have selection, we can have Darwinian evolution, and then, you know, basically selection can magically take us and produce all the rest of the complexity of life from there. All we need to get is this first self-replicating molecule. And that is the origin of life. The problem for origin of life theorists is that the origin of replication is actually an incredibly complex and difficult problem to solve. And most folks today want to propose that the RNA world hypothesis is the best explanation for where this first self-replicating molecule came from, a very special RNA molecule that can carry information, can also carry out certain key metabolic tasks, and also make copies of itself. That was the moment where life originated. Well, to produce this first special self-replicating molecule, again, that's really tantamount to the origin of information. Okay, how do you get the information in this first self-replicating molecule to allow it to self-replicate? And Jim Tuer actually alludes to this in one of the questions he asks, where he says, where does the specified complexity come from in life? Okay, so we have to account for the origin of the specified complexity to be able to explain how we get the first self-replicating molecule. And until we do that, we can't even enter into how there's selection and what selection is doing for us. And so all of Lee Cronin's talk about selection doing this or selection doing that is really irrelevant. If he cannot account for the first self-replicating molecule, he's not allowed to invoke selection. And all the questions that Jim Tuer is asking about where do the polysaccharides come from? Where do the polynucleotides come from? Where do the polypeptides come from? Those are all relevant to getting the first self-replicating system. You know, and if you can't account for that, then Lee Cronin really is not allowed to invoke selection. So how do you get the first self-replicating molecule? Well, the only mechanism that we have really is we have to be able to produce a long RNA molecule that somehow has the right nucleotides in the right order in order to allow it to self-replicate. And the only cause, it's not even a cause, but the only explanation that you can have for that is chance. Chance has to produce a long RNA molecule. And maybe, you know, obviously there's chemical reactions producing all these RNAs, but they want to envision this environment where all these RNAs are randomly being generated with randomly generated sequences of nucleotides. And you get one RNA that just happens to have the right order of nucleotides that allows it to self-replicate. So but you can't appeal to selection. Okay, Cronin can't appeal to selection to explain how the nucleotides get in the right order to allow this self-replicating molecule to arise. And that is really a key point. So again, the origin of life really comes down to the origin of specified complexity and getting the nucleotides in the right order in this first self-replicating RNA. And Tuer might not be pro-ID, but he references specified complexity. He's using an ID term that we developed because complex and specified information is the kind of information that is generated when an intelligent agent acts. So I'm speaking to you right now. You're hearing sound vibrations. These are complex because they're very unlikely, and they're specified because they match a pattern that is known to conform to words of the English language. And you immediately recognize these sounds as design because specified complexity is a hallmark of how we recognize design. So even though Jim Tuer does not support design, he recognizes that life has a special property in the form of specified complexity, and we do need to account for that. So this, finally, I'll finish this up here. This gets to the God of the gaps. You know, the claim that invoking design is somehow, you know, plugging God or plugging a designer into something that we don't understand. The problem with that accusation is that we're doing the exact opposite. We know from experience that when intelligent agents operate, they produce high levels of specified and complex information. And so when we are invoking design to account for the origin of specified complexity, we're actually invoking a cause which we know from experience explains the origin of specified complexity. We're not basing our argument upon something we don't know. It's not a gaps-based argument. We're basing it upon something we do know. We do know that intelligent agents are the sole known cause to generate high levels of complex and specified information, which happens to be the exact type of information you need to explain how the first self-replicating molecule arose in the origin of life. So Origin of Life really needs intelligent design to explain where the information came from and to get Lee Cronin the selection that he so, you know, preciously covets.
That was the first half of a panel discussion on the recent debate between Drs. James Tour and Lee Cronin held at Harvard University, featuring Casey Luskin, Brian Miller, Stephen Dilley, and Arizona State University professor Owen Anderson. Look out for part two in a separate episode. I'd like to thank the Kirkwood Center for permission to share the discussion here at Idea the Future. Learn more about the organization at kirkwoodcenter.org. For Idea the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.